So welcome to the last talk of the day, which is a keynote address and distinguished lecture by Dr. Andrew Gelman, so from Columbia University. So Andrew is a professor of statistics at Columbia University, but he's also professor of political science there. And so he's a first-class statistician who has received a number of awards from the American Statistical Association and other learned societies, and also published several books and textbooks in statistics. But at the same time, he is also a major figure in social sciences, so as famous for his very quantitative approach to political science, and with questions such as well, many topics around voting, why people vote like they vote, why polls are so bad at predicting the results of votes, why voting matters, when voting matters, and those kind of questions that are highly relevant, especially since us French have just gone through pretty weird presidential and parliamentary elections recently. And last, but definitely not least, is one of the creators and designers and implementers of STAN, the probabilistic programming language and system. And I think that for that, he would deserve a third appointment in the computer science department. So it's a pleasure to have you, and an honor to have you tonight with us, Andrew. And please.
Merci, je suis ravi d'avoir l'opportunité de donner une conférence ici. Let me first, let me talk about public opinion on abortion, just because you mentioned political science, and this is in the news in the United States with the Supreme Court changing the rules on abortions. we can get good polling on abortion starting around 1970, and up until the early 1980s, there was very little difference between the parties. If you look at public opinion among Democrats, Republicans, and Independents, they had very similar views on abortion. If you go, even when Ronald Reagan was elected president with a social conservative agenda, even at that time, there were differences between the stances of the political parties by that point, but not among the voters of the different parties. By 1992, when Bill Clinton was elected, there were some differences. That Republicans are more conservative and Democrats are more liberal on abortion, but it depended on how you look, who you looked at. And even as late as 2004, the differences in abortion by party were almost entirely among white voters. That black voters and Latino voters, there were essentially no differences between Democrats and Republicans within each of these groups. So, for example, in 2004, if you compared white people who supported abortion to white people who opposed abortion, there was a 24 percentage point difference in their support for the two parties. That is, supporting abortion rights corresponded to a 24 percentage point higher probability if you were white of supporting the Democrats. But among blacks and Latinos, it was essentially zero. And then if you break it up by whites, among whites, the largest differences were among the most educated groups. And the least educated whites had very small differences, again, by party. So we sometimes say that partisan polarization, we used to say it was a luxury. That if you're low income, you vote and have your political allegiances based on your economic issues. But if you are more elite and better educated and richer than you can afford to vote based on issues such as abortion or other social issues. So I wrote a book about that actually back in the early 2000s, but things have changed since then. The polarization is still largest among the most educated, richer voters, but now it's actually, there is some separation among the lower income voters too. And one thing that's not so well understood, when I say not so well understood, I mean I don't understand, like not like I know, but other people don't. Like, so using the passive voice to be polite to myself, one thing that's not that well understood is like what's going on with voters. Like, that is, if you take somebody, there's extreme polarization now when they have bills on abortion. When things on abortion come up in Congress, you'll have just about all the Democrats on one side and just about all the Republicans on the other. It's hard to believe that those are the personal convictions of all of the representatives in Congress, which is fine. The job of a representative in Congress is not to represent his or her personal conviction. It's to represent the voters. But there's this funny paradox because the legislators are more polarized than the voters themselves. So it's like, I don't believe that the legislators themselves all have such strong views on abortion. I believe that many or most do, but not so uniformly. But yet they're representing the voters who have weaker preferences than they do on average. So it's somewhat mysterious. And I want to say, like, I want to understand that, and I'm a little stuck, and you all might have better intuitions than I do. I think that there's an important role in social science. I think there's a division of labor in social science between people who understand what's going on and people who describe what's going on. And I'm more of a describer than an understander. Both are important. Obviously, we need the explainers and the understanders in order to make changes in the world. But we need the describers like me also, partly because sometimes we find these patterns that other people didn't think of looking at. And so we describe things, and that gives people something to explain. But also, sometimes the reverse happens, that people explain things that aren't happening. So you'll see a lot of explanations in the political media of why X, Y, and Z are happening, and they're not actually happening. And so one of the issues was political polarization. As I said, it's traditionally happened much more among the elites. But even there, the correlations are very far from 100%. There's a lot less coherence in people's aggregate beliefs than you might think. So we actually had a technical challenge, which I won't get into the details, but I'll allude to in the abortion problem, which is, let's suppose we're trying to, we have a survey question. It's a four-point question where one is you oppose abortion under all circumstances, and four is you support abortion rights under all circumstances, and two or three are intermediate stances. So we look at these averages. The average doesn't change much over time. It hasn't changed much for many decades. But if you look at different groups, as I said, you'll look at the Democrats going up and the Republicans going down. And those divisions look different for different groups of the population. So it makes sense to fit a regression model. And the challenge here, and I don't have a great answer for this either, is how to model the change over time. I just want to mention this because it's the kind of thing that comes up all the time in social science. It's like things were pretty flat for a while and then they started changing. So you could have like a change point model, except it's not really a sudden change. That's not logical. It's not like one thing happened in 1992 or anything like that. And then also, it's presumably not going to keep changing forever, right? Like at some point, the increase in the polarization is going to end. So maybe I think something like a logistic function might be reasonable, not because it's right, but it kind of has enough parameters to capture what we want. But it's just a challenge. And that's kind of how I spend a lot of my time doing. So Andrew Gordon said in his first talk, the talk that began the conference today, we should be asking the user what they want. And that's really easy because I'm the user. So I'm the user for Stan, and I can ask myself what I want. And I want to be able to fit models like that, knowing that whatever I think I'm fitting isn't really what I want to fit. And I'll kind of return to that at the end. So now let me begin the talk. So we rely on computers as black boxes. And just to speak generally, just like at the very high level, just as like consumers, right? Like we're always using our computers all the time. And much of this conference has been about validation or verification of the black box. And I'll just say, obviously, this is a general problem. We're working on very easy, well-defined mathematical problems. But of course, we're always trying to check that our satellites aren't crashing and all these other computer-related things are working. So and it's a general problem, and it's even more so an issue with probabilistic programs, and it's even more of an issue because what I already said, that I don't know what I want to be doing, okay? And so one way of saying this is that we are all sinners. And what I mean by this is that we are sinners in our models, that we are fitting models that we know are wrong. And we are sinners in our data, that we are using data that we know are imperfect and we're not correctly modeling those imperfections. And we are sinners in our computation, in that we even, that we're using approximate methods all the time. And so what I want to think about, talk about, is a kind of empirical version of verification. And so let me just step back for a second and give an analogy to building a bridge, because I feel like statistics is a branch of engineering. So if you're going to build a bridge and it's going to be expensive and you don't want people, you don't want the bridge to collapse and kill people, you're going to want to verify it before you build it. You're going to want to test it. And then once it exists, you're going to want to beta test it. And then, you know, even when it's out there, you want to evaluate it and so forth. But if we just talk about the first stage, you can think of theoretical or empirical approaches to validating the bridge, right? So a theoretical approach is you have a mathematical model and you know the laws of gravity and you have some model for things that can affect the tensile strength of the bridge and so forth, and you do that. Or you can have an empirical approach, and the empirical approach would be you build a little bridge. And you'd build some larger scale models, and you'd see what's going on, and you'd make a little graph and try to figure out how much load the bridge could take. And I want to say that both approaches are important, and neither one is enough, right? So the theoretical approach is just theory, right? So it needs to be calibrated empirically, and it's going to be imperfect. But the empirical approach alone, well, I mean, for one thing, there is no empirical approach alone, like unless you were to really build the exact same bridge first. It's, if you're going to build scale models, there has to be some sort of phenomenological theory. But of course, any empirical approach you build, you construct, will itself have potential failures. For example, just like maybe things are different. Like, I don't know, maybe the bridge is over the water and the tides affect what's going to happen, and you built all your test bridges at low tide, or whatever, right? So when I'm trying to offer or discuss empirical approach, I don't say that as a disparagement of the theoretical approaches we've heard about today. I think they're complementary, and then of course the next stage is to put them together in some way. So let me just, before going on, let me give you another example, a more generic example than the abortion example. So causal inference, you're estimating a treatment effect. Let me tell you a little story. So a few like maybe 27 months ago or so, I was called by somebody. It was pretty urgent because there was a new disease sweeping the world, and it had reached the United States. And in New York and New Jersey, people were like dying in the hospitals. We didn't know what was going to happen, and we were afraid there'd be like people dying on the street. Somebody called me because he knew someone who was a doctor who was testing an experimental treatment for coronavirus patients, and he was trying to do it very quickly, get approval, so he had to do a power analysis, a computation of what sample size he needed for his study, and he just wanted to run it by me. So he knew this guy, and this guy knew me, so he ran it. So I said, sure. So we're on the phone, and I said, what's the effect size? And he says, he thinks that this will reduce mortality by 25 percentage points. That is, like, if 55% of the people were going to die without the treatment, it would be 30% would die with the treatment. Then I said, 25 percentage points, that's a big effect. Do you really think? He's like, I think so. I think it's 50 percentage points, but I'm going to be a little conservative in this design. So that's sure. So he did he showed me the calculation. I think you need 126 people. He did the calculation just fine. And I said, but what if the treatment effect were 10 percentage points? Like, would that still be worth notable? You know, would that be, so he said, yeah, that's still worth it. Like, if it's 1 percentage point, maybe not, because a lot's happening very fast and it's not clear that, but 10, if it would reduce the mortality rate by 10 percentage points, that would be great. So then you'd need about 1,000 people. So I said, maybe you should do 1,000 people, but he didn't really want to. And so I said, and I apologize that this story kind of makes me look good and him look bad, but like, of course, he's the doctor, I'm just the statistician, right? Like, of course, we're talking about statistics, so it makes me look good. Again, this is just division of labor. I'm not disparaging this doctor. Anyway, so he said, no, he really thought 25 percentage points, not 10. And I said, well, could the effect be zero? He said, oh, yeah, of course it could be zero, because he doesn't know it's going to work. That's why he wants to do the experiment. He thinks it's going to work, but he's... So I felt like if it could be 25%, it could be zero, it could be 10%. But, like, how do you formalize that reasoning? So I thought a little bit. It's like, okay, let's say there are three kinds of people in the world. There's certain kind of people who they'll die no matter what. There's some people who will live no matter what. And then, so let's say 30% of the people will die no matter what, 45% of the people would live no matter what, and the remaining 25% would live under the treatment and die under the control. Now, if we wanted to, we could have a fourth kind of person, that people who the treatment kills. Like, it could be that it saves 35% of people's lives and kills 10%. But let's just keep it simple, right? So there's three kinds of people. The treatment effect, a randomized experiment gives you an estimate of the treatment, the average treatment of people in the study. So to say that the true effect is 25 percentage points is entirely the same as saying that 25% of people in your study are this type 3 person, the people who are susceptible, who will live only if they get the treatment. And this is standard statistical causal inference. So of course it could be 10%. Because all that would mean was that 10% of the people in the study are these type 3 people. In fact, when you design a medical study, you are kind of morally obliged to try to maximize the proportion of type 3 people in the study. You don't put people in your study who are about to die. And you don't put people in the study who are just doing fine and don't need... You put as many people in the study who you think will be susceptible to the treatment. And why do you do that? I'm not being cynical. I'm like, oh, then you get statistical significance. You can get published with it. No, I'm not joking. I'm serious. You're morally obliged, because if you think your treatment's going to work, you want to have convincing evidence so people will do the treatment. So you should do that completely as you should be. We'll get to probabilistic programming in a moment. So that's what you morally obliged to do so. But the point is that the treatment effect is not a platonic number here. The treatment effect is 0.25. The treatment effect is just a complete artifact of who's in your study. Well, of course, it could be zero, because maybe there's no type B people in the world, right? But other than that, if it can't be zero, if it can't only be zero, it can kind of be anything. Well, not completely, because you can't necessarily find these type 3 people, because being a type 3 person is a kind of latent characteristic. So you can't really design a study with a treatment effect of 100%, because it's not like you'd be able to get these people into the study. But the point is that there isn't a such number. Okay, so now we're doing causal inference, and it might be a medical study, it might be an A-B trial in a corporate setting, might be an experiment they're doing in Twitter, like all sorts of positive, Microsoft, maybe a new version of Clippy that they're developing, whatever it is, we're interested in the average treatment effect in the population. To estimate that, we can estimate the treatment, we don't want the average treatment effect in the sample. So we can fit a model, a regression model, predicting the outcome, giving the treatment, and having that treatment interact with important pre-treatment predictors. And they can be individual characteristics and also situational characteristics as well. Now, this is statistically challenging because to capture differences between what's happening in our experiment and what's happening in the real world. Even in a randomized experiment, to capture differences between what's happening in the experiment and what's happening in the real world requires adjusting for many things. Not just differences between people, but as I said, like differences between scenarios, also latent characteristics, like customer behavior or health status. So it's a big challenge, which is why we might write a big model in Stan to do this. Also, these interactions will be noisy. A simple calculation shows that you need 16 times the sample to estimate an interaction as to estimate a main effect. I won't talk about the details of that calculation here. But the point is that if you're looking to get things if you run an experiment that just barely gives you the inference you need for your main effect, your interactions are going to be very noisy. So we have to accept uncertainty. Accepting uncertainty has an important practical implication. I'll explain, again, this arises in the corporate setting, but I'll give you a kind of, say it in the medical setting. There's something called evidence-based medicine, and it has three precepts. One is to use formal decision analysis with costs and benefits and probabilities. One is to use randomized clinical trials and definitive results from statistically significant studies. And the third is to get individual recommendations for decisions. And those three recommendations contradict each other. Because if you want individual recommendations, you can't wait for statistical significance, because it's not going to happen. Because individual implies deep interactions and noisy estimates. So, and then things get even more complicated if we add latent variables to our model. Now, how does probabilistic programming fit into this? Well, we can write this model in Stan or some other probabilistic programming language. We can put in priors for parameters in the model, and that's going to be very important. And also, we can include latent variables as additional lines of the model. So basically, we can complexify things as needed. Wait a second. Okay. So now I want to get back to what much of this meeting has been about, which is about validation. So many years ago, before Stan, back when we programmed these models, these things anew for each model, we noticed that we had lots of failures. We had bugs in our code. We had conceptual errors in our simulation algorithms. We had poor convergence. We had bad models, just flat out bad models. And so we came up with this idea of simulation-based Bayesian calibration. And it goes like this. You first draw parameters from you have a prior distribution for the parameters in your model. So first you draw parameters from your prior. You say these are the true parameters, or the assumed parameters. Having drawn the priors, you then simulate fake data from your probabilistic model. Now, I just want to say here that simulating fake data requires more effort. Well, it's computationally typically easy, but conceptually it requires more effort than inference. Because to simulate fake data, you need a generative model. And a likelihood is not actually a generative model, which is a technical point, again, I won't get into here, but just to say that in some sense, it's not automatic. So once we have parameter value we drew from the prior, we simulate fake data, then we fit our model to the fake data, and we have inference, we have estimated parameters. We compare those to the parameter. We say, oh, the 50% interval should have a 50% chance of including the true parameter values. The 90% interval should have a 90% chance. More generally, the true parameter value or the assumed value should be uniform within the distribution of our posterior distribution. Well, you can't really check the coverage of 50% intervals with only one simulation, so you have to repeat the whole thing. And if you repeat the whole thing, then you can actually find errors. And also, when you don't have an error, then you'll find that you'll eventually not find an error, and you'll feel a little better about yourself, right? So that's why I said it's already kind of empirical, because it's only asymptotic. You're not getting any finite sample guarantee. So what are some problems with this simulation-based calibration? Well, first, it's expensive. An adaptive approach works better in practice. When I say an adaptive approach, I mean you take one draw from the prior, you get the parameter, then you fit the model once. Sometimes it's so obviously bad. Like, you know, it's not like, oh, my 50% interval doesn't include the true value. Oh, I got a bad coin flip. You know, it sucks, man. It's like my 50% interval is here and the true value is out here, right? All the time, right? That happens. Well, of course, we can do this, as I said, you can do this adaptively. But then even beyond that, instead of sampling theta, the parameter from the prior distribution, you can pick a reasonable value. I'll get back to that in a moment. But like can pick a value because often your prior includes lots of stuff you don't care about. Now that's kind of changing, but I think if you look at a lot of probabilistic programs, including ones that I've written, we don't always think that hard about the prior. And as a result, like the prior includes all sorts of things you don't care about, but who cares? Because they're not in your posterior, so it doesn't matter, right? So like, you know, I weigh this object on the scale, I have a uniform prior in its weight, and then I weigh it, and it weighs 50 grams. Well, the fact that my prior included 8,000 kilograms doesn't matter because it's not there. So anyway, I can pick a reasonable value, I could even draw theta from the posterior. Then it destroys my statistical properties, so I can no longer expect the right coverage, but it will catch these big problems. We like to say that we want to fail fast, and there's also something called the folk theorem of statistical computing. I don't know if you've heard this, but the folk theorem of statistical computing is that when you have a problem with your computation, you often have a problem with your model. And so we want to find these things right away. The second problem with full-out simulation-based calibration beyond speed is that, what about approximate algorithms? So in real life, we use approximate algorithms, like HMC is approximate. Variational inference is even more approximate. Then there's other stuff that's maybe more approximate than that. So I think that what I want to do, what we want to do is move from what I call an offline simulation-based calibration to an online version. And that so in an offline simulation-based calibration, we draw from the prior and we do it 1,000 times or maybe just 100 times, whatever, and check that we get the right coverage. In online version, we would do it just maybe a few times. We would be drawing from the posterior rather than the prior, and we only want a probabilistic test. Offline calibration is, I would say, it's a test of correctness. of the model and the computation. It's only a probabilistic test, but it's a test of correctness. What you want is that to not reject the null hypothesis that everything's perfect. And what I think we want is not a probabilistic test of correctness. I think what we want is a probabilistic measure of incorrectness. Okay, remember, we're all sinners, right? So the question is, how bad is it? How far off are 50% intervals? Now, there are these weird things. As I said, if you draw from the posterior, like depending on where your data are, you shouldn't expect nominal coverage, because your nominal coverage only occurs averaging over the prior. On the other hand, if your coverage drawing from the posterior, if your 50% intervals all have 99% coverage, then it might make you wonder, like, what's going on with your prior? Or if your 50% intervals, like drawing from the posterior, have 2% coverage, then I think it's likely that there is some sort of problem. Possibly the problem is just that you saw a really unusual data set, but in that case, that's a sort of posterior predictive check all on its own. So it's in some sense it's a different way of thinking, and I don't have the answers on this one. I think there's, in some way, we're really combining two things now. We're checking correctness of the simulation or accuracy of the simulation process, or correctness or accuracy of the probabilistic programming, and we're also conflating that with fit of the data to the model. But maybe that's okay to be doing both at once, because we kind of care about both things at the same time. Okay, let me mention a few applications and talk about failure modes, just because I think this is important. So I told you about the example of the A-B test, and there the failure mode is, I think the failure modes are either that you don't adjust for enough things, so you're not getting a good estimate of the population average effect, or that your prior is too weak, and as a result, you're getting implausible, very noisy estimates of individual effects and averaging poorly. So in the situation, you have the randomized experiment, but you care about the population. And one thing that I think people aren't, I think you all as computer scientists realize this, but a lot of statisticians don't, is that there's no safe haven. So a lot of people have this idea, like, I have a randomized experiment, so look, I can at least do the classical thing. I get the unbiased estimate, and I'm okay. You know, I could do something more fancy, maybe, you know, do some decision analysis, but push comes to shove, I can just do the standard, right? But no, that's not really true, because if your sample is not a random sample from the if your data are not a random sample from the population, then even if you have this randomized experiment, you're only estimating the average treatment effect in the sample, not in the population. And to get that requires some modeling and some assumptions. So there's no safe haven. Like, not adjusting for stuff doesn't work. Adjusting for lots of stuff and using least squares is not safe either. That can be super noisy. You have to do some regularization. Some choices need to be made. That introduces failure modes. I mentioned the abortion. The kind of failure modes there, we're estimating time series. So there's two things. One is we have separate opinion polls in different years, and the opinion polls are noisy. So do too much smoothing, and you can miss real changes. Not enough smoothing, and you end up overreacting to things. The other failure mode is extrapolation, right? So you fit a spline or whatever, you fit a quadratic, whatever parametric form you fit, you're going to have stuff happening when you predict out to the future, or even when you make inference at the end of the time series. So we have to be aware of that too. Earlier, someone mentioned election forecasting. I think like the failure modes have to do with uncertainties that aren't fully acknowledged. And I think there we have to maybe be expressing more of our forecast conditionally. I think that one of the issues is we make an unconditional forecast, including the possibility of polling error, systematic polling error, but people don't really understand that. And so I think there we have to broaden how we express our inferences. But that's kind of a separate direction, but I just wanted to mention that as another way that things can fail. So given that we live in this world in which our models are all wrong, how does that fold into workflow? And so I want to give you a series, like six different probabilistic programming workflows, but I'll say them each quickly. So workflow one starts like this. You write your model in math, then you translate it into a probabilistic program, then you run it on data, and then you look at the results. That's workflow number one. Workflow number two is similar, but it reflects the fact that our probabilistic programs are really good. So our first step is write your model in the probabilistic program. You don't need to write in math anymore. I know, of course, the math is there, but like I can just type a model. I don't actually have to write the algebra first. Then the next step, run it on data. The next step is look at the results. Okay, that's workflow two, but that's not enough. Then workflow three. First, write your model in the probabilistic programming language, then run it on data, then look at results, then post-process. Because we actually don't care about our parameter estimates or even individual predictions. Typically, we have decisions to make, and those decisions are not parameters in the model. So that's why it's useful to be working in a language like Python or R, where we can post-process our inferences. And that's why we call stand from those programs. Okay, but now that's not enough, so there's workflow four. So workflow four starts the same way with workflow three. Write your model, run it on data, look at the results, post-process, but then there's check the fit to the data. So do posterior predictive checks, simulate replicated data and see how they differ from the observed data. Then go back and change the model. That's kind of where we were, like, until recently. But then I have two more workflows. So workflow five is just like workflow four, except we're using approximate computing algorithm. We might be using variational inference for reasons of speed or stability. We might be using HMC, but it's a hard problem, so we have to think of it as an approximate algorithm because we might have convergence issues. In that case, we need to also do some validation of our software, as we've talked about. So it means in addition to everything else, I fit the model, I write the model, I fit the model, I do it all, I do the computation, I get my inferences. Also, I need to clone a process where I simulate fake data, and I fit the model, and I check that my fake data can recover the true parameters to the accuracy I want. So that's another step in workflow, and it's interesting because it's a parallel step. You're cloning it. It's not a sequential step. Of course, that's good news, right? It's parallel because that way we can just use parallel processing, and it's free, except that we're using it to burn the planet down. Then finally, workflow six, which is similar to workflow five, that we're fitting a model, the computation is recognized to be approximate, so we clone it and we check that, but we recognize that we don't know what we're doing with our model, and so we're doing this over and over again with different models. And I was talking with someone today who asked, like, is that like version control, like you keep making a new model? I said, it's not quite like version control, because in version control, the latest version is the one you want. In this case, it's like a version of version control in which you want to understand how you got from point A to point B here. So maybe I start with a simple comparison, which the treatment versus the control, I'm regressing in a constant term. Then I adjust for sex and age. Then I adjust for some previous health measurements. Then I adjust for some situational factors like who the doctor is, what day they came to the hospital. Then I adjust for some latent variables on previous health status, which requires a more complicated model. Oh, maybe this is the model I kind of like. Well, maybe not, but like I want to understand how I got there. So there's something we do in applied statistics. We tell stories like, oh, here, the initial estimate was the treatment had a very small effect. But after you adjust for sex and age, it turned out that it had a much larger effect. Oh, why is it? Oh, because actually the treatment was more effective on young people than old people, but our sample had tons of old people, in our data had tons of old people, and when we do that adjustment, that changes things. And then when we adjust for the latent characteristic, this changes, well, that's more complicated. Let me show you this graph of how that hit. Right, so we do all that. Well, that's important. Well, there's this whole thing about explainable AI, which is great. That's all in the context of a single model. And now I'm talking about this in multiple models. I'm not saying this is one big Bayesian model and there's a posterior probability for each of these models being true. They're all wrong. I'd like to use this model, but I understand this model by getting back to here. And so there are technical challenges. And I think this is really another talk, but I think much of the history of statistics and data science is the history of things that seem soft becoming formalized. It used to be that checking a model was considered to be a soft skill, making a graph, right? But now there's people study these things, right? Even hierarchical modeling. It used to be that's empirical based. There's this thing you don't know the prior, so you estimate it from data. It's kind of cheating, but it kind of works, right? Right. So as computer scientists, you can relate to this, right? Something is a good trick, and then you kind of come and formalize it. So I want to say that this understanding, not just understanding a single model, but understanding this pathway is important. It's worth studying. I think it will be formalized and automated eventually. And I don't want to insult it by saying, oh yeah, it's just a Bayesian thing, you're averaging over models each other. No, that's not true. Our theoretical frameworks get larger. You don't have to be like George W. Cantor to realize that our theoretical frameworks get bigger as we do more things. Right? Let me just see where I am here. Yes. Oh, and so I guess wanted to say again to continue the Cantor collect diagonal argument here that it's interesting to me that it's not only that our models become more complicated, but our very understanding of workflow itself becomes more complicated. That when we wrote Bayesian data analysis, we were on workflow 4. In my list. I got to workflow 5 and 6. And workflow 4 is already a big advance. Previous Bayesian books were at workflow 1, actually. And so let's not get trapped in our theoretical frameworks. I think that these workflows, there's going to be more beyond my workflow 6. Okay, and I feel like I've learned a lot by trying to formalize my thinking. Again, this relates to the comment in the very first talk about how we should ask the user, and again, the user is me. So for me to say, what am I doing and what am I doing wrong? And kind of just resisting the attitude of saying I already have the answer. Not only do I not have the modeling answer, but I don't have the workflow answer. For me to say, oh, yeah, it's all Bayes, right? Here's the posterior probability. No, Bayesian inference is a tool within a workflow, and it's not even all BDA or whatever. If we return to that causal inference example, as I said, you start with a simple comparison, then you can adjust for customer or patient demographics, situational variables, and so forth. These steps are part of the workflow, and it arises in other problems too. And another characteristic feature which is relevant to today's conference is multiple levels of uncertainty. That is uncertainty about uncertainty. And an example comes up with election forecasting that we're uncertain on how uncertain we should be about the polls, and we have to kind of try to explicitly model that. So in summary, simulation-based validation has, in my opinion, deep technical challenges relating to workflow. And the challenges come in if you think about validation as being an adaptive online process where you might find a problem, like there's a population of problems out there, and you might find the problem right away. It might be that the very first time you clone your process, you find an obvious problem, or it might take longer to do that, especially given that we are fitting approximate models. So there's kind of a lot more research to be done, I think. And I think the ideas here, like the theoretical ideas that were presented today are really great. And like it shows how challenging it is even in a kind of non-workflow-based setting, even to test a fixed implementation is challenging. But at the same time, as we're working on perfecting that, I think we should be thinking, I hope I can motivate you to think about the technical challenges that go beyond. My second part of my summary is we are dog fooding it. I mean, we do like eat our own dog food, fit the models in Stan. Not that you need to do that, but it does make a difference. The third point is that data analysis, doing data analysis is like being a scientist. And what I mean is it involves experiment, like being a scientist, like in kids, like if you're fourth grade and they tell you what's science, like you make a hypothesis, so it's like that. You make these hypotheses, like I think this model is kind of okay for my abortion problem. It's not a statistical hypothesis. The hypothesis, or it's like, I think I'm not quite there yet. My hypothesis is that I don't have the time series fully modeled correctly. So how do I assess that? I could do some experimentation, gather some data, I might simulate fake data. So I might say, I fit this linear model with a change point, and I don't think that's going to work. So let me simulate some fake data where the truth comes from a logistic curve and see what I can recover. And then maybe it'll turn out my hypothesis is false. Maybe my change point model is actually pretty good for the sample size I have, right? But here is it, like this is not in the books, including my own, okay? This idea that doing data analysis on a fixed data set, like even that, it's like you're acting like a little baby scientist doing stuff. I have this idea, this might work, let me try this, let me simulate this. Then validation, software validation is really part of that, because I have a hypothesis that Stan or whatever my PPL is can fit this model okay. That's what I'm really doing. But again, I don't want to test the hypothesis. That's like so 20th century testing statistical hypotheses. I want to evaluate, I want to measure the difference, my distance from the hypothesis. How wrong am I? And taking this perspective seriously implies a complete rethinking of how we do probabilistic programming, validation, and computational social science. I'm just like thinking that a fixed model and fixed data is a tool that we use. It's not where we are. It's not our belief. It's a step in our workflow. But all this is implicit in what we already do. That is our workflow and what we talk about, right? Like for example, why do we care so much about scalability? Okay, it's not just because like we're helping people fly fighter jets or whatever and everything has to be done really quick or you get blown out of the sky, you know, by some Ukrainian or whatever. It's also that you are like scalability is because in most of the applications I've seen, it's not that people are in such a hurry right away, it's that if they took a month to fit this model, they would have no chance to improve their model. And so I think a lot of scalability is in the workflow context. There's a lot of things that people really could spend more time on if they already knew what they wanted to do. And getting quantitative scalability can make you a qualitatively better model. So I think we're already there. Like we're living the world of workflow. We're living the world in which data analysis is a scientific process. We're just not fully recognizing that. And I think once we think carefully about what we do, once we dog food it, and once we ask ourselves the question of why am I doing what I'm doing, we have huge vistas of research opportunity. And it's so exciting to be here and listening to all of you talk about these things.